Well, funny. Okay, so a couple of weeks ago, my best friend, Mikey, he comes up to Nordhoff to play a football game. His son plays at Moorpark, JV. So I'm going to meet you at the game. This is so exciting. It was like 110 that day. You know, like literally, worst day of the heat wave. And he brings his wife and his in-laws and his father-in-law. You know, he's in his 80s and he's pretty hammered. You know, he's got lots of issues and he's just melting. Looks like he's just going to die, you know. So, and the stands were just facing the sun and it was just reflecting. It just looked like an oven, like one of those. So I'm like, nah, dude, come on. Just come on over and sit on our side. It's in the shade. And the old man's like, I don't know. You know, I don't want to get any trouble with your fans. And I go, this isn't Compton, which is like so racist that I said that. I was like, I just thought about that afterwards. I'm like going, what? You know, I go, this isn't Compton. You're not going to get beat up. I go, come on. I go, this is Ojai. So he comes with us and the whole family entourage and a few of their friends come too. And we get into the stand. I'm talking JV football. There's like 35 people out there, right, in our gigantic stands. And they sit down, and next thing I know, the kickoff just starts. The game just starts. First drive. Apparently, one of Mike's friends, his wife and his friend and his wife and their daughter were sitting there, and he cheers his son because he made a tackle. And this guy just goes ballistic, just starts using every foul word you can imagine, just dressing them up and down. And he was sitting up a little bit above us, and get out of here, you don't belong on this side, you go over there. And the old man's looking at me like, I told you. And I'm like going, oh, God, you know. And this was like 2 weeks ago, and my body was still kind of achy, you know. And then another guy gets involved, and then thankfully some Nordhoff people tried to put a stop to it, but then it became like a crowd, and there was pushing and shoving and shirt grabbing and people trying to separate. And then I think, you know, I'm not feeling good, but I assess the guy, and I'm like, I can take him, even in my current condition. I have a absolute concrete head. Now, I may not be able to hit you because my hands hurt, but I'll headbutt you to death. And I'm going to tell you, I have been concussed so many times in my life, but I've never been unconscious. So it's just a warning, right? So I come climbing up the stairs, and this whole brouhaha, and it finally calms down, and we separate. And then from then on, I felt like the biggest idiot, you know. I was just sitting there with our people. But this is kind of a little bit what I want to talk about even this morning. And I guess I'm into my time right now, right? So I can segue to today's message. Even as we're going to be talking in the last few minutes about small groups and some of the things that we get to do together, we've asked reasons, like, why do we do this? Why do we come? Why do we come to church? Well, obviously, it's to worship God. I mean, God is God, and we love to ask the questions that surround that. And mostly for me, I love to focus on the incarnation of God as it's revealed through Jesus Christ and his life and his teachings to us, teaching us how to live sanely in an insane world, i.e., even what we're experiencing in our daily lives in a football stand, at a football game. People want to fight at a football game. And we think there's, you know, that the Middle East is tough, you know, and you wonder why. You're like, wow, at a football game, people want to beat each other up because we're from the other side. It's just like, wow. So we're talking about these things. As we get together, we focus on Jesus and focus on his teachings to us and his his process in our lives. Process of salvation isn't just like, oh, God saved me and now I'm... No, it is an ongoing, outworking thing that takes place. So I'm going to talk today a little bit about sinking ships. I want to show a video moment if we got it. Again, we're still in the working out the bugs. We've got some new equipment. The good news is we got new equipment. The bad news is we got new equipment. So we're still working out bugs and things like that. Vic, if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. At this point, we'll not worry about it. But I'm looking for my clip that I want to show from the movie Titanic. Now, most of you know the Titanic story. You know, it's like the Christmas. Everybody knows it. You know what happened. You know, 1,500 people drowned. And 700 survived in that thing. Any luck, Vic? No, huh? 50-50? It's just frozen again? All right. Well, we'll work it out. So anyway, so the Titanic, we know the gist of it. It is probably one of the greatest catastrophes and shocks in modern human history. Most of you know the story that when it sailed, it was its maiden voyage. It was the largest ship ever constructed. It was the most opulent. Everybody who was anybody was on that maiden voyage. It carried some of the richest people in the world, some of the most famous people in the world. It had luxury like nothing before. It had safety features, the most modern navigation equipment, all these things that were in there. And yet the boat sank. It sank. It went down to the bottom of the ocean. And if we look back at that and we look at the reasons why, we know it struck an iceberg. But the truth is, as often the case, in hindsight, as we look back, it wasn't a unavoidable disaster. In fact, the disaster was so avoidable, it could have been so easily avoided, that it makes the magnitude of the tragedy that much more. And it would have taken just little things. Did you know that they had a miscommunication and a shortage of binoculars? And one of the guys who knew where the binoculars were didn't even get on the ship for that maiden voyage, and nobody knew where the binoculars were, but nobody thought that was a big deal. So they had their lookouts in the particular spots where they were at without binoculars. And even just that, just what would have been maybe a $3 or $4 pair of binoculars at the lookouts could have averted potentially the disaster. There were several transmissions that came in from other ships marking and commenting and alerting people to the icebergs that were in the shipping lane. And those came in and were shelved. It wasn't passed on. It wasn't noted as something serious. They were at a full speed ahead sail. Even a slight reduction in speed because of that acknowledgement that there were bergs in the area could have averted the disaster. And so it is often in life. When we look back with hindsight, when we look back with that 20/20 vision in situations in life, in others' lives, or in our own lives, that often we can look back with that 20/20 hindsight and say, gosh, if I would have just made an adjustment here, if I would have just taken this seriously over there, if I would have just addressed this issue when the opportunity came, it potentially could have changed everything. It could have averted disaster. So I want to look at a few things today. One of the things, if we look at the Titanic, is we realize it was considered unsinkable. That's basically the clip that I was going to show you. What was going to show is that the berg had struck and the captain is sitting down. They're sitting down with the chief engineer and some of the investors, and they're sitting around the table at just initially in the moments as they're getting a damage assessment, and they're rolling out the plans, and basically they're saying, guess what? The engineer is saying, we're going down. And the shock and awe in everybody's faces, it was really well acted out. It's palatable. They're just, one of the investors is like, wait a minute, this ship can't sink. It's unsinkable. And he's like, no, it's irreversible. We're going down. Well, what about the water pumps? The water pumps are just buying us minutes. But it's not going to stop the inevitable. The ship is going down. The people were absolutely stunned. And I think sometimes that's it. You think like, man, my situation or me or my relationship or my marriage or my business or my whatever, it's unsinkable. I mean, we are untouchable. So there is that. Warnings were ignored. Communication was shelved. These communiques came in. And sometimes we do that in our life. There are these signals. There are these flares that are going up. There are these flags that are there. There are things that we should notice and we should be picking up. And maybe we initially do, but we don't take them seriously and we begin to shelve them. And we don't think that it's going to really cost us down the road. But the truth is, down the road, it becomes an irreversible catastrophe because we didn't take seriously some of the warnings that were coming. The communication was shelved. And it was ill-equipped. In other words, they started the journey, in one sense, totally ill-equipped. Because of the arrogance, you could say, And because of lousy maritime administration, you could say as well, the ship only had enough lifeboats for about one-third of the capacity of its passengers. I mean, just kind of think on that for a second. All right? In fact, when the ship was built and taking off, they threw on lifeboats, so to speak, as an afterthought. It's like, this thing is so, it's not going to sink. What do we even need lifeboats for? So they dressed it with lifeboats, just enough to make it look like there's lifeboats, and just enough that one-third of capacity passengers could even get into a lifeboat if they had the chance. Now, the thing went down so fast, and it was so much catastrophe and confusion that even the lifeboats they had weren't fully filled. They could have saved at least 500 more people that went down and drowned because of the commotion. But one-third, they felt like, man, we've done enough. Now, I do a lot of marriages, and it's marriage season again. And I did a wedding, yesterday, and I did a wedding last week, and I got one coming up again, and a lot of weddings. And I actually enjoy doing weddings. I do. It's an exciting thing. I love particularly meeting with the couples. More to me is my time with them than it is actually the ceremony. The ceremony is exciting. It's beautiful and touching. But I love to sit down with couples and chat with them and talk to them and listen to them. I know that statistically speaking, it doesn't matter if they're Christian or not, it doesn't matter what they are, that 50% of the marriages that I'm going to perform are going to fail. They're not going to make it. And as I sit with these couples, I'm sometimes just kind of like, wow. I'm looking at this young couple. I'm looking at what they have in love and friendship and commitment and dreams and all these things. And while I'm not negative, I believe in the sense that when I do a marriage, that everyone I'm doing is going to go the long haul. It's going to go till death do them part. But I also know in the decades that I've done this, that's not the case. And 50% are sinking ships. So I did a wedding yesterday, and we talked about love and commitment. We talked about the words of love and what it means and how you act it out. And it's always just a sobering and touching thing what a marriage has evolved to today in our times, right? And I mentioned that too because a lot is being said about marriage today, right? I mean, a lot, right? Especially in Christian circles in the church and gay marriage and all these things. Which I was glad yesterday I reminded the community there that I was doing perform the marriage about traditional biblical marriage. That traditionally a biblical marriage meant that the husband owned the wife. She was property. That's a traditional biblical marriage. You're property. You're owned. This is your master, and you are subservient to him in everything and every way. That's a biblical marriage. Also, a biblical marriage might also mean that he might have other wives because there's nothing in the Bible that says there's anything wrong with having more than one wife. And quite frankly, some of the greatest biblical figures in the Bible had many wives. In fact, they also had these things, concubines. This is not what you take out into the field, okay, for a crop, not combines, concubines, a little different. And apparently, God doesn't have a problem with concubines because he never, ever says anything about having concubines. So in your biblical marriage, I just want you to know that you, woman, are a piece of property. He's your master, and you might have more than one wife, and you might have some concubines, but get on with it, okay? Because this is biblical marriage. A biblical marriage might mean that the girl is 12 years old or 11 years old or 13 years old. The fact is, most biblical marriages, girls were very, very, very young when they were married. A biblical marriage means you probably never have met your husband because all the marriages were contracts, social contracts that were arranged. It was a transaction, a covenantal transaction. So many times, the 12-year-old girl would meet the man that she was going to marry, and they would meet for the first time, and they would see each other for the first time, and they would consummate the marriage to the sexual act. And it was important that she was a virgin. Why? Because this is a covenantal business transaction where the bloodline is the point and the purpose. You have to have a pure bloodline. You were very fortunate if you were able to marry off your daughter at 12. Why? Because it meant in a world as brutal as it was back then that this woman would have provision and care by a husband. I don't care, even if I don't know the guy. He's married. It's a contract. He has to take care of her. That's why you wanted to marry your daughter off. And why did you want your son to marry? You wanted your son to marry. You got to see. Have you guys ever seen a Fiddler on the Roof? You got to watch that. Why did you want your son to marry? You want your son to marry so he can have children. The point was procreation, children, sons, a continuum of the line. So this is biblical marriage that we so badly want to go back to, right? So this contract. But today we don't see that. We've evolved to a place where we see men and women as equals, and we see men and women, at least most churches do, not all, but most, and that there ought to be something really important, which is love. Love in a marriage. Love. Now, when we talk about love, there are several words that go around that. All the words, and there are several, that are translated out of the ancient languages into the English are all translated into that single utilitarian language of English where love is the universal word. So we get kind of messed up. We love football. Stephen loves the Bears. Mate. So much so that I know he's not in church this morning because the Bears are playing. Okay? Just calling him out right now. Is that on? It's on. We're recording, right? I want that to be on the iCast, you know, when he gets this. No. We love our wives, but hopefully we love our wives differently than football. We love our children. We love our family. There's several different words that are used biblically throughout. We have the word agape or ahava in the Hebrew. Paul talks about agape love when he talks about that in what is a very famous, famous passage, 1 Corinthians 13. Paul, this Jewish rabbi, writes to a church in the town of Corinth 2,000 years ago, and he gives them qualities of love. It's patient, it's kind, it's not self-seeking, self-serving, it's long-suffering. It's all these qualities of what love is. What you will find there, though, is that they're all practically, they are, and what I mean practically, not all practically, but they are all in their practice, actions. The agape word, ahava word in the Hebrew, love is an action. It's what we do with that word. It's void of feelings. It has actually nothing to do with feelings. Now, that's kind of strange because we read that love chapter, and most people, when we read that at a wedding, we don't really understand. It's really not talking about what we're thinking of a love, like the fuzzies. When Jesus says, love your enemies, he's not an idiot. He doesn't expect us to have warm fuzzies. He's just saying in the way that we act towards our enemies, we are to act this way with the qualities that are demonstrated in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. The feeling love is a word called phileo in the New Testament, or raya in the Hebrew. And this kind of love, it's all, again, this is the same word, the different words in the ancient languages, but all translated love in the English Bible. This kind of love, phileo, is like where we get the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia, from that root word. Phileo is a kind of love that is loaded with affection. This is the heartfelt love. This is a love that a mother and a father have for their newborn child. It's just like, boom, wow, you know. This is the love that we think of if you're like me, and I was really blessed with great parents, but I was particularly close to my mom. I mean, I had a special relationship with my mom. I was a mama's boy. I love my mom, and my mom loved me. It's the kind of love you have. Your brotherly love, between your siblings, your best friend. I love my best buddy, Mikey. I mean, I love him deeply, and I'm deeply loved by him. That's this phileo, affection love. And then another word is dode in the Hebrew, or eros in the Greek. And you maybe get from eros, erotic, erotica. This is a different kind. We translate it love, but what we really mean, this is more of an intimacy of the physical nature. And that aspect, obviously, is unique, right? So when you marry somebody, you kind of have this triune in the way that it ought to be, this trifecta, this trinity, this triangle of commitment in the way we act, affection in the way we feel, right? And then we have eros or dode. We have this erotica, this this thing like, woo, I get funny feelings when I see you or I see her. Or it was, oh, that's that spark of, wow, I saw her when first time I ever saw her, she walked in the room, or first time I saw him, and I was just like, whoa, something just, whoo, I had butterflies in my stomach. That's kind of what we're talking about here when we talk about love. And people bring all these things to a marriage and to a relationship, but often the ship sinks. But I'm not talking specifically about marriage. I'm talking about all kinds of relationships, relationships between us as brothers and sisters in Christ, other followers and church members, relationships in the workplace, relationships in the family dynamics, relationships between your loved ones and extended family members and friends. This is it. And a lot of times we have challenges. To me, it's amazing that any of us can get along, right? When I listen to a man and a woman when they get married, just as an example, right away something strikes me. They're very different. They're male and female. Need I say more? I mean, this is just a biological factor. Men and women, if you don't know it, are different. We are different in many, many ways. That difference is even biological. Somewhere in the conception, in the formation, there comes that moment where the sex is determined by the chromosomes. We know that, and certain chemicals are released, including that chemical of testosterone, and it clamps down, particularly on the male, and it does some things to the male brain that are very interesting. It clamps down on that side of the brain that that really deals with emotions, the most emotional side. Men are slightly brain damaged there. Okay? This is the truth. And we need to get some sympathy. Now this well, when I get when I do the marriage counseling and he's just like, the guy just, he's unfeeling. He doesn't talk to me, he doesn't communicate, he doesn't cry. He doesn't seem to care. That's the way it seems often the case to the woman. Like, I got this guy, and he just has no emotions. And I'm glad to tell her, he's brain damaged. You need a little sympathy for the guy. You know, he's a man. But you get my drift. Women are very emotional. I mean, you see that. You know, I mean, and the difference is, I mean, I'm driving down the highway, and an animal jumps out in front. Kathy would scream. If she was driving, she would swerve. I, as a man, caring for my family, know that I must accelerate and aim right for the animal. Okay? This is what you do if you want to avoid an accident, right? A man can do this. Oh, no, a deer! You know? Whereas Kathy would be like, no, it's just, we're wired differently. And that's it. We know that sexually. Men are, you know, as has been said, I think it was men are from Mars, women are from Venus, or whatever it is, that book. But it's true. Men are the sexually are the microwaves, you know. Quick, bam, we're ready to go. Women are the crockpots. Starts in the morning, setting low. It's gonna take a good 7-8 hours to simmer. It'll be just right when it hits. The guy's just like, grab me the pizza, boom, bang, whee, I'm ready to go, you know? And it makes for challenges. We have different backgrounds, our families. Kathy came from a very, very quiet family. I was astounded when I used to come to her house and not hear anything. You know, it was just like amazing. Her dad would be working quietly, her mom would be on the computer, and we'd sit down and have dinner, and it'd be like quiet and calm. I mean, my house was a freaking knockdown dragout. Everything from making the meal to eating the meal to cleaning it up. You know, the volume just keeps coming because people are competing to get heard, and it's just absolute chaos. And these kinds of things, whether you come from a kind of a Greek, you know, my big fat Greek wedding type background. Have you ever seen that movie? It's old, I know, but it's classic. You see those two different family styles. It causes challenges. There's different temperaments. Temperaments. We have different personality types. I put that down. There's the phlegmatic, choleric, sanguine, melancholy. I like to call it this. I like to call them, the phlegmatic is, I call it the lovers. The lover, the leader, the laugher, the laser. A lover is a person who's just naturally bent that way. You know that. I know who you are. I mean, you're great. We just had a meeting and somebody took on the job because we have people who are having surgery like Ansel, and we have people who've just passed away like Chuck Sitton just passed away. Chuck used to sit right over there by you guys over there, and Chuck and his wife Ruth, and I got to spend some time with Ruth and the family, and I'm going to be doing his funeral next Saturday. Ruth is an amazing woman. Chuck, an amazing guy. But we have people who say, man, we should be writing cards, and yeah, exactly. You're the card writer. That's the phlegmatic, the lover who's immediately attentive and caring. You have what I call the clerics, or the leaders. These are the people that, you know, charge ahead, lead football team captains, those kind of guys, CEOs of company, visionaries. You got the laughers, or the sanguines. The laughers are people who just have that personality where they get along with everybody. They can just enter a room and not know anybody and be in conversation with five different people in no time, make friends, you know. And then you've got, and you know those kind of people in your life. And then you've got the melancholies, which a lot of people think sadness, but in the clinical term it means these are people that, what I like to call lasers. These are very linear thinking people. The way their mind and brain works, it's about laid out. I mean, I've used this so many times through the years, but I got to use it again. The perfect example of those personality types I experienced almost all daily, but one of the most classic where I saw it all was about 10 years ago at an Ojai Little League baseball game. And this is these little kids playing baseball, and this kid pops up towards the third base, and the kid runs underneath it. You know, we're all watching. It's kind of a little unsteady. He gets under. Just a little guy, and the ball hits him right on the head, right? And just poof, he just falls down. Immediately, the response was everything. You have the phlegmatics, the lovers, who immediately were like, women start, I mean, there was actually some people, and guys, you know, like, oh my God, somebody call an ambulance, you know, running out to attend to the kid. It's not even their kid. So those are the phlegmatics. Then you got, the leaders, the clerics, right? And what are they doing? They're yelling at the kid on third base to take home. Go, 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 you know. Forget the kid that's bleeding, lying next to you. This is a competition. We got a chance to score. Run, run, run. So they're screaming run. Other people are crying. You've got the melancholies, the analysts. They're the coaches. You know, and I'm listening. Well, you know what? He didn't have glove in right position. If he would have, you know, got under that ball, you got an extension there, and if he would have had the flip glasses, that probably would have helped too. They're analyzing the situation. And then last but certainly not least, you have the sanguines, the laughers. And what are they doing? They're freaking laughing. You know, I mean, because it was kind of funny. I gotta be honest. If you saw it, it was like kind of funny. This little kid, poof. You know, you're just like, ha ha ha. Get over it. It was so funny. You know, I mean, that's it in a nutshell. And those are all the way we are wired, and that doesn't mean that you're evil or you're better than somebody else because you're more sensitive. Those is just the way we're wired. It's just the way that we are. And this is often our strength. To be a lover is a great quality. To be analytical, to be a laser, is a great quality. We need that here in this church. I need people who love instinctively, people who can just go, woo, like Victoria, what a compliment she is to me, because she could just go, woo, you know, let's just, poo, we need to lay this out. We need to get teams, we need to get a chart, we need to get this, we need to get that, and I'm kind of like, I don't know, whatever. But this is good. We need that. We need laughers. We love people that just can come in and just immediately be friends to people and are approachable and not scared to approach somebody else. I know those people because often if they're visiting church, they'll come up to me. Hi, I'm so-and-so. This is my first time here. I really enjoyed that. Matt, what you said about that. You know, they'll start a conversation. Never met me before. And that's the way they are. And if you look at the, so your lover, your leader, your laugher, your laser, those are all important. Now, here's something I teach time and time again. That is just the way we are, and that is a good thing. Our liability tends to be, however, that good thing out of control, ungoverned. Okay, so consider this. That's the leader, guy who has visionary and the guts to go out there and do it. But if he doesn't have something governing that, tempering that, the next thing you know, he's just walking over people. He'll get A to B, but in the rear view, there will be all kinds of carcasses lying in the way. You got the lover, the people who love, 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 love. Sometimes they love, 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 love so much they can't draw any healthy boundaries. They can't draw healthy boundaries with their kids. They can't say no. As an employer, they can't draw healthy boundaries with their staff because they want to be everybody's friend. But the problem is you're not. You're the boss. And there's some times where you got to behave like a boss, and that doesn't work, and it gets fuzzy. Or they just give to everybody else, but guess what? They run out of gas for themselves. Or they end up doormats. They're just loving, and their kids walk all over them, can't say no. And they just run amok. But it's out of control. Leaders, lovers, laughers, great. Make friends, a million of them. Out of control, you got a million friends. And what's that mean? It means you got a lot of friends, but it's all an inch deep. You haven't gone deep with anybody in a long time. You haven't had a long, deep, lasting friendship because those take time. Those take cultivation, and if you're an out-of-control laugher, you're just out there making friends. And if you lose a friend, it's no big deal because it wasn't that big of a deal to begin with, so I can go over here where I got more friends, and you just become this person that passes through. You see that. You know, I see that often. I see that in churches. People come in, I'm in the church. I'm the laugher. Woohoo! Oh, God, it's so good to be in this church. I want to be involved with that. Sign me up for this. I'm here for that. Woo, 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 woo. Got friends with everybody, the potluck, the whole thing, and then like 2 weeks later, they're gone. And they're at another church doing the same thing. Woo, God, isn't this a wonderful church? I can, meet. Somebody said something and it hurt them or whatever. And those are the negatives. There are all those quality things to the positives and the negatives. So this is common stuff that can cause conflict. We have different communication styles. I love talking about this. One of my favorite things to talk about, and I haven't done it in a while, that's why I wanted to do it again, and Kathy said you ought to do this again, and that is our love languages. Therapists will tell you that there's basically five ways to love, and they're all good. We all do them to one degree or another, the way we express and show love. We do that, and it's on your sheets here. You show your love. Did I put it on the sheet? Yeah, with touch. Yeah. So physical touch. And many of you know me. And I love to say hello and give you a hug. It's the way it is. It was that way my family growing up. My immigrant family came in here. It was a very touchy family. So when guests arrived, there was hugs and kisses and hellos. That was very, very touch. But that's an important aspect of the way we show love. I mean, from intimacy, from the eros kind of love to the phileo. Brotherly kind of love, we can do that still with physical touch. That's very important. Okay, that's the way we show love. We also show it with time. I think of time, it just means that we carve out, we interrupt our schedule for the things we love, whether it's golf, football, or our wife, or our children. We just say, I'm carving out time here for this. I'm going to give time to this person. That is another way we show love. Jesus did these things, by the way. And I love it, like when he healed the leper, he reached out and touched him. It's so huge. This amazing scene where Jesus, a leper, calls out to Jesus, and he's not allowed to approach him as a rabbi. In fact, he's supposed to stay more than a stone's throw away. How do you know? Because the Bible says to stone any leper that comes close. So you have to stay at least a stone's throw out of hitting range with a stone. But he calls out to Jesus, and Jesus closes the gap. He falls before Jesus, and he asks for healing. And Jesus, he could have launched the healing. He could have shot it like a, three-pointer. No. He walks up, and before he heals the guy, he touches his broken face. A man probably hadn't been touched in God knows how many years. And all of a sudden, he felt human touch. And then he healed him. Right? He took his disciples. He would say, we need to get away. Jesus himself would retreat. to a lonely place where he would pray and be alone. But he would take his disciples often with him and just give them time. So touch, time, service. The things we do for other people show us that we love them. We know this. This is how we serve somebody else. Jesus washed the disciples' feet. He washed them. He took on the form of a slave. And he said, this is the way you should treat one another. Nothing's below you. Serve one another. It shows love. Gifts. We bring gifts. In fact, the Bible describes Jesus as the indescribable gift, that he was a gift to humanity. His life, his death, his resurrection was a gift of God's love to us. But we see Jesus also anointed. Mary, Martha's sister, comes in and just breaks the alabaster jar of perfume and pours it over Jesus. A life savings poured out. She gives this gift as an anointing to Jesus. In Shimon, the Pharisee's home, where Jesus is reclining, being trapped. We looked at that some weeks back. This sinful woman, a prostitute, comes in and lays at Jesus' feet and brings her alabaster jar of perfume and pours it out on Jesus' feet as a gift, a love offering. So we show that way. We have words. I think one of the most common ways we use them is words. We tell people we love them. We tell people they're special. We tell our kids. We have words of affirmation that we can tell people. All those ways are ways that we show love. Now, what's interesting is, because of the way we're wired, some of these ways speak louder to us in other ways. My wife, for example, is all about service. She runs a big household. She's got a lot of things on the plate. And when I show her love, it is literally, what can I do to help her? If it's washing the dishes, if it's cleaning up the bedroom, if it's picking up after this. And I know that's important to her. So, I mean, I knew, there's compromises. I'm going to talk about that in a moment. She likes, my clothes to be not all over the floor, which is like usually where I just tend to, and unfortunately, every one of the kids has followed me. Okay? No, it's true. I feel so sorry. It's like, for her makeup, it's almost a little bit like hell, right? Because the kids just come in, shoes are flying off, they're just, and she's trying to do it. But I've gotten good at picking those things up, and I'll get my own stuff. Now, in her closet, things are ordered. My closet, it's not. It's kind of like this. Just trying to cram stuff in there and close it. But if I can get it crammed in and closed, success. The floor is clean. She's happy. So there's service, right? These are all very important. Different things speak different to different people. The challenge for you at any point in your life, because it takes reevaluation, because these things change. Things change as we change, as we get older, as we're met with new challenges, is to find out, what is it that speaks love to your spouse? I mean, I may come home with a dozen roses at the end of the week for Kathy, but she's really not a gifts gal. It's not that she doesn't appreciate that. Don't get me wrong. But what I'm saying is, if I haven't been helping her a lick all week long, and then I come home with a dozen roses, dude, she might hit me with them. I mean, it'd be like, what, you think you can buy me off with $10 roses from Vons? Like, I don't know that. I shop there. Oh, I thought it was going to be special. No, it's not that. No. You taking out the trash would have been special, That would have been special. So we have to know what it is that our love language is, and what our love language is of those that are around us. I mean, it just helps to know that. And there's always signs. You just have to be alert and listen for them. You have to look. What is it? We tend, and people tend to do to others what they like done to them. I've heard that before, right? So my dad, for instance, loved gifts. And he loved to give gifts. That's it. He loved to give gifts. I am a person that I'm a words person, right? So nothing fills my sails like my wife telling me, "Wow, that was awesome. What you did in that situation, that was really great. You really diffused a bad situation. That was awesome." And it fills my sails. I'm words affirming. And I tend to do that. I tend to be the person that loves to tell other people, you do a great job. You're amazing. Now, the problem is that that's what I tend to do. And that may not hit the button for other people. And I have to be aware of that. And oftentimes I'm not. It's not always easy. I mean, I may say it all day long, you're great, you're great, you're great. But it might be that for this person, a little gift given to them would be like, oh, wow, this really makes me feel special. I may have told them they're special 100 times, but it just didn't connect. Doesn't mean they don't appreciate it. Doesn't mean they're ignoring it. It just means it's helpful for you and for me to know the languages of love. These are things I'm saying because I think they can avert disaster, sinking ships. We can be sensitive and understanding to the way people are wired. And that means a few different things. We understand the differences, whether it's being a man and a woman. We understand our differences in communication. We understand our differences in backgrounds and temperaments and the way we're wired. And it helps if we practice these things to diffuse and prevent blow-ups or disruption or anger or hurt. And then we can take ownership. The next thing we got to do is we got to understand the way we are and yet be sensitive to the way people who aren't us are. How do they need to feel loved? For some people, in the marriage counseling I've done, I've had it so many times where the woman's need is like, gosh, I wish he would hold my hand in public. Now, from the guy's perspective, it never occurred to him. He loves his wife. But when they're out, he's, you know. But what she wants is like, can you hold my flipping hand? Put your arm around me. And, you know, could I have a public display of affection? You know, could I? And we need to be aware of these things. We need to do that. In a sense, we need to honor. Romans 12:10 says, honor one another. And that word there, it's a word we've spoken about in the Hebrew is kavod. Kavod, it means give worth, value, weight. The actual word means weight, heaviness. And what it meant is back in the ancient times, if a man was very wealthy, he was demonstrably wealthy because he had wealth, he had gold, it was on him. He was heavy laden with treasure. That man had weight. And he had power, and he had presence, and that was valuable. And now we use that you know, we say that about people. That guy carries a lot of weight, you know, around here, or she throws her weight around, or whatever. And it means there's an influence, and there's a power, there's a value there. But what it really means, kavod, to honor, means to attach high value to something. We attach high value to those in our lives and the relationships we have. And then we try to, because of that high value, meet people and communicate with them and love them in a proactive way. And that means in the way we touch, the time that we spend with them, the service that we extend, the gifts, the words that we say. We take into consideration different personality types so that we can be complementary and not competitive. It does. My wife is very different than me. She's not competitive like me. And I have to understand that. And I have to know my limits and boundaries. Probably not good for us to play on the same side in doubles tennis. Because I'm going to tell her, I think you could have got that if you would have dove for it. You know, I mean, I'm just going to tell her, you know, I think a little more effort out of you. And she's just like, I'm having a good time. No. The good time is in winning. This is how you have a good time. That's the way I was trained, right? So we have to understand these things. So, and I'm going to tell you right now, having a sense of humor about this helps, even when you've blown it. Just to admit that and own, this is the way I am. Have your partner or your friend or your coworker or your kid go, oh, okay, that's it. And I'm working on it. I'm taking this into consideration and I'm working on it. So these are things that we can look at as we go through. In your outline, when I think about this situation of the Titanic, when I think about what we can advert, James says in verse 19 of chapter 1, he says, be quick to listen, slow to speak and slow to get angry. If we want to guide our life in a way that we can avoid some of these titanic things, that we can, as I sit down with these people that I'm going to marry off in a few days or a few weeks or a few months, I try to tell them, look, check this out. Be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to get angry. There's a lot of lessons right there, man. You want to improve your communication skills 1,000% overnight? Shut up. Listen. And I say that to you as one who's not judging you, as one, as I'm thinking you can guess, who tends to run at the mouth, who tends to have the answer figured out, you know, can do that, can hurry right through. I got caught on one of those puzzles that they put on the internet. I saw it on Facebook, and it's just a progression thing. And it tells a lot about you, actually. It's just a series of numbers, and then you're supposed to guess what this number would be over here where there's a question mark. And I, like so many other people like me, gave the number, and it was the wrong number. And I'll tell you why. Because as soon as I looked at that thing, and there's maybe like a set of six or seven numbers going straight down, I looked at one, two, three. I recognized the pattern right away. I saw the pattern. It hit me. I went right down to the bottom, figured it out. Here's the answer. Wrong. Because they jacked with the numbers down below. They were waiting for people like me who just think, oh, yeah, I see it. I know it. So I'm just going to skip the rest. Who does that with the instructions? Yeah, let me just go down to the end. Okay, here it is. Boom, I can put this thing together. I mean, I've done that so many times. A quick scan and then just, okay, here's the end. This is what it looks like. So as long as I take these parts and the screws and it looks like this, I'm on the right track, right? And then you find out, disaster. So this can happen. So what we want to do here as we conclude is we want to wrap up on this thing. We're going to bring up some people. We want to have behavior that is honoring, and that starts with listening. I love Dale Carnegie's old timer, but he said something. He said you'll make more friends in 2 weeks by becoming a good listener than in 2 years trying to get others to listen to you. That's so funny. That's so good. So how do we honor? What's the honoring? What's an open versus closed environment? An open environment is one where there's listening, understanding, where there's time, where there's empathy, where there's encouragement, where there's accepting, where there's grace. I mean, like, okay, forgiveness, big time, undeserved, unmerited, and there's inclusion. That's an open environment, an honoring, kavod, I'm attaching value, dishonoring. Then we get into the Hevel environment. That's that famous word that we did in the book of Ecclesiastes, mist. The opposite of kavod is Hevel. This means a mist, smoky, light. It means we don't really care about what you think. You know, when people say, he just blew me away like I wasn't even there. That's that irreverence. That's where you get yelling, condemning, judgment, blaming, sarcasm, threats, comparisons, and exaggerations. I close with this. Behind anger is pain. Behind pain is an expectation. Behind an expectation is a need. And behind that need is a sense of my value. And when we try to meet one another's needs, when we try to care for one another, as we try to honor one another, there's a sense of value. I am now valued, and I care. Now, are we all going to do this perfectly? Absolutely not. The truth is, this stuff that I just shared is stuff that I've got to work through in one way or another on a daily, if not weekly, basis, because it's so easy, as I've said before, to forget. Right? So my challenge to you is not just to forget this, but to take this and begin to think about this and the really important relationships, to start there. The really important relationships, to start there and think about these things, because they make a difference. And they can make all the difference in the world on a voyage from one shore to the other. It can get you to the other side and through the rough waters.